Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 9th of January 2021. This is another podcast in our series, Interesting Times. And in it, I discuss the matter of free speech. This is a topic that I've discussed and analysed before, and I suggest you do go back over the podcast and you'll find somewhere a few years ago quite a good podcast, I think, on this subject. What's triggered this revisiting of the theme of free speech is the Twitter ban on the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump, throughout his presidency, now coming to an end of 4 years, has made frequent use of Twitter as a means of propagandising and mobilising his base. And sometimes the president has been in the habit of tweeting many, many times a day. Mr. Trump was first banned for 24 hours and then subsequently banned for, in perpetuity, so it seems. The reason given by Twitter is as follows. Quote, after close review of recent tweets from the @RealDonaldTrump account and the context around them, we have permanently suspended the account due to the risk of further incitement of violence. End quote. Of course, all of this is apropos of the insurrection at the US Capitol by Trump followers who had just earlier attended a Trump rally at the Washington Monument and on Trump's instructions had marched down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. They broke into the Capitol, received little resistance from the rather ill-equipped and poorly staffed Capitol Police. And there were various ructions. You can hear an account of this, which I think is fairly accurate, in our previous Interesting Times podcast. And there's obviously a lot of discussion going on about the significance of this event. So it's in this context that Twitter have banned Trump. And naturally, the banning has been accompanied by a furore. It's been discussed on the BBC News, on the radio this morning. There are lots of different takes on it, all over social media, and it's a big deal. But basically the talking point is the control of information by the tech companies, the social media companies, and how that impacts on free speech. And there's some fairly general discussion about the whole free speech debate as well. As far as I know, at this time, Trump is still able to tweet through the official White House Twitter account because it seems that only the @RealDonaldTrump account has been suspended. Though by the time I'm saying this, that state of affairs might well have changed. So what's gone on here and what is its significance? As a way into answering these questions, I'm going to consider information. You will have heard me say frequently on this channel that whoever controls information controls the world. But what is information? Now, I am using the term information in a particular way. I am saying that what information is bits and bytes, signs and symbols, sentences, words joined together in grammatical structures in order to communicate meaning, relate events, give analyses of events, make connections between events, and so forth. Now, I'm using the term information here to include both true and false statements, both coherent and incoherent narratives, and both useful and malignant structures of discourse. So we can talk about true information, false information, good information, bad information, but I'm taking the term to mean the whole caboodle. So bear that in mind as I go through my analysis. We should also bear in mind that a large and significant body of information, a large proportion of the information in the world, is circulated in the public domain as public discourse, and a very, very good deal of it circulates through the internet and involves electronic media. Print media also involved, but remember that print media is slowly sinking into oblivion at the moment. Also, some information is kept within small domains, and it's kept secret, you might say. And such information is often concealed from the public. Also, a lot of public domain information is designed to conceal other information, which the owners, if you might call them, or the custodians of that information want to be kept secret. And the other operation that happens with information is that it's composed into structures, articles, podcasts, documentary films, newspaper editorials, pieces on TV, and so forth. In short, at the moment, there is considerable struggle over who controls the internet and what the internet should be allowed to do, and what it should be forbidden from doing. And there's a lot of debate about who should do this, allowing and forbidding. And this goes right to the heart of this conundrum around free speech that this Trump incident has brought to the fore. Similar contestation arises in relation to other forms of information dissemination. And it's in this context that the far-right news channel, along the lines of Fox News, 24-hour news channel, is about to be launched in the UK. In fact, I think there's more than one. And millions of pounds are being thrown at this. And people around the Spectator right-wing journal are involved with some of these initiatives. This, it seems to me, is in response to the low-budget, do-it-yourself left-wing alternative channels, which are being developed and which are doing quite well, though in a small way. Clearly the right has discerned this and is going to build its oppositional news media, and rather better financed, given that billionaires are backing these initiatives. So, who controls information controls the world, because information, particularly mass media, particularly the internet, influences people. A point not lost on Cambridge Analytica, and a point that was well made by the 2016 US election and the 2019 UK election. On this basis, you would certainly want to say, well, free speech means that all the ideas that people have can be out there, they can compete, they can vie for attention, and that this should be a productive process, a way of utilising our collective brain power, you might say. This was an idea that John Stuart Mill had about free speech and open public debate. He saw it as overall a good, which could help us to refine our ideas, identify our collective values, and so forth and so forth, as well as being the fundamental operation, perhaps, of building a diverse and modern culture. I have to say at this juncture that my own instincts are in favour of free speech. I want to be able to say what I like and think what I like and to discuss ideas on pretty well any subject or any events that can occur in human life. However, this isn't a black and white issue, and this is a point I really want to make. Free speech isn't just a simple good that's self-evidently necessary and a right and a good. It shouldn't be treated as a black and white matter. It's full of contradictions and tensions. There's a reason for this, and the reason is that speech acts, certain speech acts, can have a material, concrete effect. They can actually change the world. They can incite people to do things. And I think that this is what philosophers call performative speech acts, which are speech acts which go beyond just merely being utterances that evaporate into the ether and just do sort of descriptive jobs. Some speech acts, performative speech acts, actually do bring about a change in the world. I mean, such speech acts would be like contracts, promises, oaths, evidence you might give in court, or a political speech, or, you know, rabble-rousing political speech. Maybe when Rudy Giuliani spoke to the rally on the 6th at the Washington Monument and claimed that perhaps politics or this particular political moment should be treated as an opportunity for, quote, trial by combat. That was a speech act which produced certain realities in the real world, namely the insurrection at the Capitol, which incidentally resulted in 4 deaths. And when the President of the United States addressed a crowd of Proud Boys wearing Civil War T-shirts emblazoned with the slogan MAGA Civil War, January the 6th, 2020, or the ones who were wearing the 6MWNE T-shirt, which incidentally means 6 million were not enough, referring to the Jews who were killed by the Nazis. And when this very significant daddy figure, Donald Trump, the president, told them that he loved them, that maybe in that case a performative speech act was in fact occurring. Now, there's a very common argument against free speech which recognises that certain speech acts have this quality of being able to actually make real material and concrete changes in the world. And the famous one is that we shouldn't allow people to shout fire in a crowded theatre, resulting in a stampede and then resulting in injuries as people get trampled underfoot or crushed in the panic. Obviously, this in the context of there not actually being a fire in the theatre. And very few people would insist on free speech being extended to those kind of events. And this is probably the argument, or an argument of this type, which the officials at Twitter would use if pressed to justify their banning of Donald Trump. Therefore, some control on free speech is inevitable, even in societies which are generally committed to it as a right of the citizens. But there's a twist. It's inevitable that power concerns or interests will want to control information. And they have the perfect excuse that there is a kind of a common sense limit to free speech. Even the most ideologically free speech platforms, the most committed free speech platforms, I'm thinking of social media like Minds or Steemit, and even they draw a line beyond which you can't go with your free speech. I mean, for instance, they're not very keen in having child pornographers in their communities. And they draw the line at anything illegal because obviously they don't want to be falling foul of the law and getting into trouble and having their people prosecuted and their platforms dismembered. But even they will draw a line under it. Similarly, nobody is going to argue that we shouldn't have libel laws which stop you from saying what you like, because you shouldn't have the right to ruin somebody's reputation with falsehoods or to destroy their livelihood by telling lies about them. By now, it should be apparent from this discussion that there are a lot of ins and outs and a lot of issues surrounding the issue of free speech, not least this one. On the one hand, certain common sense constraints on free speech are not too onerous on the citizen, and there are certain practical utility in protecting the public safety and the public good. On the other hand, controlling information is controlling the world, and power interests vie with each other for control of the world. And power is not only the means for accumulating more and more wealth, which the 0.01% of the population are utterly dedicated to, but it's a reward in its own right. And I think Nietzsche was right about power and large amounts of power, that it's a drug, an aphrodisiac, an intoxicant. And it will be sought in its own right. But of course, accumulations of wealth and power in the hands of very few means the disempowerment of the many. And the disempowerment of the many means resentment, frustration, misery. So it is political. Some people think it should be so. It should be this way. It should be that a few people have the wealth and the power. And one of the arguments put forward goes along the lines that this is the natural order. The caste system of India particularly goes along these lines. Not only is it the natural order, it's the divine order that wealth and power is concentrated in very few hands. Another argument along these lines is put forward by none less than Plato, though it might be that Plato has been rather ironic when he put this forward. But the non-ironic reading of Plato's Republic is that Plato is recommending that a very small minority of rulers, guardians, are in possession of the information about how the world works, about how society works. But this is kept secret from the mass of the population because the mass of the population are too stupid to make use of it. And it's best that they're kind of kept in the dark and fed some fairy stories to keep them quiet and pliable and manageable. And, of course, this is all for their own good. And this is an argument that is still abroad. The age of the internet, of course, has compromised it just by its very technical nature, that we can talk to people all around the world and compare ideas and throw up memes and start flame wars and Twitter spats and pylons and all the rest of the features of our wonderful modern age of communication. Let's add another complication, just in case you're still thinking that this is a nice black and white matter. There's an argument that goes like this. It says that Twitter is a private company. It's owned by private capital. And as such, it can do what it likes. It can allow people on who it likes, and it can forbid people from using the platform. There are terms of service There are community standards, all of which you sign to, even though I doubt you read it because it's small print and very lengthy, when you do sign on for a Twitter account. And that is their prerogative, with obviously within some limits, but they are not actually obliged, given the legal setup, to offer an equitable access to their platform and their technology, which allows people to at least vie for the attention of the millions, possibly billions of people who use the Twitter platform. Now, Twitter, and indeed all the other social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube and so on, have got their own imperatives. Apart from having some obligations to public safety, which, if ignored, would have a bad look, these social media platforms rely on selling advertising to make revenue. This in turn places pressure on the type of content that the platforms are going to promote and are going to monetize. And we have seen recently, particularly on YouTube, the demonetization of left-wing platforms. So they don't take them down, but they make it difficult for them to earn any money. And of course, big capitalist advertisers don't want to advertise on left-wing channels. At times, this profit motive has distorted public perceptions to the extent that the shenanigans between Cambridge Analytica and Facebook probably secured Trump his election victory in 2016. So moral corruption is never far away for that age-old reason that the bottom line and profits are God. This inevitable capitalist-induced bias, this distortion of news and facts, is very influential on public behaviour, unfortunately, but there it is. Especially when there are, especially when the platforms are utilised to particularly to engineer social behaviour through the use of behavioural science. This has not gone unnoticed by governments and people who know how to lobby governments, many of whom have called for government regulation of the social media platforms. I do actually think there's a mistake in that call, because it presumes what shouldn't be presumed, and which goes against the evidence, that governments are good actors. And we know that very often governments are not good actors. They're the wrong people to do this regulating, because they will introduce their own bias and their own quest for power will be in play. A lot of what social media platforms do by way of selecting which channels will be promoted and which will be allowed to monetize and so forth, and which will actually be banned, is left up to the algorithms. In other words, to an automated artificial intelligence, basically. This can lead to some funny results as well. I'm going to tell you a funny story about this. I think it was only the other day that Anna had received a notice from YouTube that a short video which she had posted was not suitable for people under 18 and that it was going to be classified as an 18 plus. So what on earth was she putting in her video, a little 30-second video? Well, I can tell you, it was just a little video recording of the tide coming in, just of the waves lapping up onto the beach. And that's all it was. No soundtrack, the only soundtrack being the beautiful sound of the sea. But Anna did give the thing the title, Another Sunny Day During the Apocalypse. So it seems that word apocalypse, I can presume, triggered the algorithm to think that there was something fishy going on and that the video needed to be classified as not suitable for people under 18. Anyway, this is what we're up against, and governments feel they need to wade in. And to be fair, there is some pretty nefarious shit. The Cambridge Analytica story with Facebook, and it is worth inquiring into that, but it really is a horror story. But the government are not going to be neutral actors either. So what we've got at the moment is a power struggle between the tech companies who want to do it their way because that's how they make their money, and they make a lot of money. These are incredibly wealthy companies on the one hand, and on the other hand, the government wanting to get its hands on the social media and provide some kind of regulation. So that is basically the thing we need to understand about this, a power struggle. Actually, we need to understand really that there is conflict between different factions within capital. The big tech capital is pulling in a different direction and has got different agendas from finance capital, Wall Street, City of London, the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate, the rentier sector. And that has got different interests from the old-fashioned extractive and manufacturing capital, big oil, big pharma, so on. They have different interests. And it strikes me that Wall Street's sort of quite keen on letting the fash strut their stuff, because this is kind of rather good for their business. Anything that opposes socialists, who would, at the end of the day, if they got their way, be rounding up the Wall Street bankers and punishing them for their crimes and basically dismantling their enterprise. So there's a lot of different pulls, some governmental, some from capital. There is actually another force that would like to control this medium of information circulation, this incredibly powerful medium of information circulation. And that, I would call it roughly like the geeks or the crypto-anarchists or the cyberpunks. And these are the people who do want an uncensored internet, a people's internet, a decentralised internet, not controlled by the big tech companies, but not controlled by the government either, people's internet. And there is work in this direction using blockchain and helping people to keep the money that they make potentially for their own content creation and so on. And it's kind of utopian, but there is a lot of work going on sort of quietly in that sector, up to and including the idea that to get free of the tech companies, that one needs to have one's own infrastructure even, and there is even work going on in that direction of producing a real alternative internet that can't be censored and that allows people to share their information. But all the problems of free speech are still employed and imbricated in that initiative. We should, of course, mention that the government, which is a player, one of the reasons why it's not going to be a neutral player is that it is basically most Western governments have been bought by the corporations anyway. And I suggest you listen to my podcast on the economy and its relationship to fascism. Fascism 3, that one's called. And you'll see that I demonstrate there that the government is basically fascistic, the British government. But we can demonstrate the same thing with the US government because it is completely entangled with and bought by the big corporations, particularly the military-industrial complex, but other sectors of private capital. So the sense the government is this kind of pure actor, and it's not this pure actor because of how much it owes to its donors and how completely entangled it is with the mega corporations. Okay, let's now try and summarise where this discussion has led us to. There are some common sense reasons for placing some limit on free speech. But as far as I can see, that adhering to those limits isn't particularly onerous on citizens, and it shouldn't necessarily stop us from discussing pretty well all ideas. And it's this common sense reason which claims that a certain attenuation of free speech can be called upon to protect the public interest and public safety is the reason that Twitter would appeal to justify banning the POTUS Donald Trump from its platform. Incidentally, I just found out that Trump's been banned from pretty well every platform that's going out there. Certainly Facebook, but I don't know, Instagram and all these. A whole range of them, maybe a dozen popular platforms have banned Trump, as well as Twitter. But we shouldn't be deceived by this appeal to a common sense notion that the attenuation of free speech is sometimes justified, because the social media platforms are completely embedded in capitalism and in making lots and lots of money, mainly through the selling of advertising, and sometimes rather nefariously through their ability to manipulate public behaviour, particularly public political behaviour and voting behaviour. And it's this side of the activity of platforms that has given rise to a subtle censorship of free speech under the imperative of the interests of the platforms themselves. This in turn has given rise to opposition from government and calls for governments to intervene. And no doubt you will have seen Mark Zuckerberg looking sheepish at congressional hearings where he's been called upon to justify himself in this context. But then we shouldn't get carried away with the idea that the government's going to be a defender of our interests in this forum, because the governments themselves are pretty well captured by sections of capital, particularly big capital and particularly finance capital. And they're not neutral actors either. So, in short, there is a many-sided war over who exactly will control the internet and indeed the other media of circulation of information. The billionaire-owned press, for instance, again, an interested party. And we should remember, again in this context, that there is a tech movement, a geek movement, to free the internet of any of these constraints, as yet nascent, but possibly in the future significant and powerful. The line that I took in my much earlier podcast on free speech was to say that the problem with free speech is that free speech itself can be used to undermine free speech, and that that's where vigilance was required. And that, of course, I haven't backed away from that. I think that is in play in the midst of all this politics and kerfuffle. And my answer then is the same as my answer now, that these tensions and contradictions are only going to be resolved for the general benefit by a rise in the general level of education of the population. If we have people who can't be dog-whistled, as Trump has been dog-whistling his base, who have a critical faculty and will question what the media are saying, who will do the research necessary to identify interest when it's at play on social media platforms, on the internet. Then free speech will be a very great good, rather than a rather uneven good, and at times a positive force for malignant public discourse and the chaos that ensues from that. So, educate yourselves, have a critical awareness. There are ways of doing this. It's hard work, but give it a whirl. I recommend it. We need to be able to discuss all manner of things, perhaps even the unthinkable. At the same time, we need to have a certain independence of being and thought that makes us somewhat resistant to dog whistles, nonsensical irrationalities that are peddled, wish fulfillment fantasies that are peddled, and gives us some degree of clarity. This doesn't mean to say you are never make a mistake and you are never mislead yourself or ever get misled. Wittgenstein famously said, there is nothing more difficult than not deceiving oneself. And we need to bear that in mind and take it very seriously. At the same time, selective scepticism leads to all kinds of nonsense. We have to be very careful with it. Scepticism taken to the limit is paralysis. But on the other hand, complete gullibility for anything that appeals to us. Ideas like the Queen being a lizard and all the rest of it are equally dangerous. We need to understand trust, and when we can trust, and we need to understand the degree to which we need to be sceptical and the degree to which we need to attenuate scepticism so that we don't become paralysed, unable to think, unable to commit and unable to act. This is kind of tricky stuff, but analysing the situation, as I've tried to do here, rather sketchily, on the basis of a single but rather significant event, the banning of the President of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, from one of the most popular social media platforms, in fact from all of the popular social media platforms, gives us something on which we can chew and something which we can analyse and something which we can scrape away at and look for the foundations and the archaeology and the processes that are involved. And in that way, I think little by little, we can be in a position to use debate, to use ideas, to use thought, to use the sharing of ideas, to occupy the discursive sphere, which of course, you know, is technologically mediated very largely by the internet these days, and to work for the many and not the few, and work for humanity and work for moving forward into a future that anybody in their right mind would want. So I hope that's helpful. Enjoyable even. So remember to wash your hands and make knowledge great again. Thanks for listening. Thanks to patrons for bunging us a few quid. Over and out, and lots of love.